This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, one of the fun things about doing live radio is that you can continue the conversation that was going on previously. And so I would like to indulge in that just for a moment, if you'll indulge me. I want to say the context of ongoing murder means allowing a platform for groups like Nazis or the Klan or the alt-Reich is collaborating in armed intimidation. For example, suppose you're in an auditorium and you wanted to hear a speech about the situation in the Middle East, and a uniformed ISIS member approached the podium flapping a flag. Well, that's an act of armed intimidation. Everyone would be clear about that because you don't really know whether that person has an explosive vest on or not. So there's a context. Persons associated with ISIS wearing black flapping that flag tend to explode themselves, and so you'd really be kind of wondering whether you were going to survive the encounter. So it really doesn't matter if the person so dressed came up to the podium to say that he liked strawberry ice cream. Doesn't matter what he says, because everything that he does and says is an act of armed intimidation, because, as I said, you don't know if you're going to die. For example, to continue, let's say a Klan member approaches the podium. Well, this is an act of armed intimidation. Why? Because the Klan is a long-standing death squad. The Nazis are a long-standing death squad. They've killed millions of people. The Klan in the United States is killing people. And so for the people of color in the audience and transgender people like me, you'd really have to wonder if you were going to survive the encounter. What will the Klansmen do? Now, it's the nature of the Klansmen or the Nazi to run you down, shoot you, drag you from behind a truck. Later, when they can catch you, when you're outnumbered, and when they think no one's looking, but that doesn't change the fact that you might not survive the encounter. It's an act of intimidation. That's why you don't let the Klan up on the stage. Are you listening, ACLU? It's not about hate speech. Somebody wants to say they hate me, that's just fine. It's a little obnoxious. I don't enjoy it, but it doesn't mean I'm going to die. But if the Klan gets up on the counter, if the Klan gets up on the podium, or the Nazis or the alt-Reich who are hiding the Klan and the Nazis, then yeah, there's a question of how am I going to be doing after this? So it's legitimate for me to say, don't put the Klan and the Nazis up on the podium. Don't give them the platform simply because they are murderers. And now here's the corollary that my fellow white people need to pay attention to. When you, as a white person who profits from every day, white person who has a comfort zone, it's a cheap and lousy comfort increasingly. But if you're a white person and you say that the Klan and the alt-Reich and the Nazis deserve a platform because of free speech, you are collaborating in an act of armed intimidation now, aren't you? Because you've got these people under your wing with your whiteness, and you're saying that really they're not death squads, even though they're death squads. And you're saying they're not engaging in armed intimidation, even though they are. And so if you as a white person say that they deserve free speech, again, are you paying attention to ACLU? Apparently ACLU is starting to pay attention. Then you are collaborating in an act of armed intimidation. Hate speech, smate speech. It ain't about hate. It's about who's going to die. So this is not a complex issue for me. And if you as a white person in the presence of people of color or trannies or something, that really the Klan and the Nazis should be allowed to say what they want when they want, don't be surprised if fist comes crashing into your face. And if it does, well, that's an act of self-defense. So if you don't want to be defended against, then don't collaborate in armed intimidation and murder. I hope that's clear, but you know, I think that maybe it's just not. I think that a lot of my fellow whiteys listening to me just aren't going to get that, but you better. Well, now, this is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know, so let's get on to the news. Chicago Tribune asks, in a state built on air conditioning, millions of Florida residents now want to know, when will the power come back on? Hurricane Irma's march against Florida and the Southeast triggered one of the bigger blackouts in U.S. history, plunging as many as 13 million people into the dark as the storm dragged down power lines and blew out transformers. Gone were the climate-controlled bubbles people relied on in Florida's sweltering heat and humidity. In Hollywood, Florida, 8 patients at a sweltering nursing home died after Hurricane Irma knocked out the air conditioning, raising fears Wednesday about the safety of Florida's 4 million senior citizens amid power outages that could last for days. Hollywood, Florida, Police Chief Tom Sanchez said investigators believe the deaths at the rehab center at Hollywood Hills were heat-related and added the building has been sealed off. We are conducting a criminal investigation. Meanwhile, millions who evacuated ahead of the storm are now returning to homes without electricity. They could face days or even weeks with little to ease the late summer stickiness. By Wednesday afternoon, state emergency management officials estimated that one-third or 6.4 million residents remained without power in the Sunshine State. And speaking for myself, this comes in the context of increasing propagation of bacteria such as E. coli in the floodwater. In Havana, Venezuela became the first country to send humanitarian aid to Cuba in the wake of devastation caused by Hurricane Irma. This is from Radio Havana, Cuba. The first aid shipment arrived in Havana Tuesday, September 12th, on board an aircraft of the Venezuelan Air Force and consists of 7.3 tons of cargo, mostly mattresses, water, and canned food, along with a message of solidarity from the people of Venezuela and President Nicolas Maduro. According to accompanying the aid was the Venezuelan Minister for Women and Gender Equality, who said that her country is ready and willing to assist Cuba in any way it can as an expression of infinite gratitude and solidarity. She noted that Cuba has always accompanied and supported Venezuela through the most difficult times, and she was quoted saying, "This is why the Venezuelan people and their Bolivarian revolution are forever committed to the Cuban people and their revolution." She announced that further donations from the Venezuelan people to the Cuban victims of Hurricane Irma will arrive shortly. Meanwhile, Cuban Deputy Minister of Foreign Trade highlighted the gesture of solidarity from Venezuela and its support at this difficult time. Many countries around the world, especially in Latin America, have expressed their solidarity with Cuba in the wake of Irma, which battered the country for more than 72 hours as a Category 5 hurricane, hitting 13 out of Cuba's 15 provinces. And speaking for myself, the death toll is not nearly as high as you would expect from the country that took the brunt of the hurricane at its Category 5 level. The place was shredded, but before the hurricane even hit, the Cubans had begun producing, for example, extra electrolytes. All the pharmaceutical factories in the country ceased production of what they were making and started making electrolyte water in anticipation of the hurricane. It's too bad they can't get that electrolyte water in Florida right now. And the bakeries baked all night, even as the winds rose, as the Category 5, we're talking 185 miles per hour, hit Cuba. The bakeries, even when they lost power, kept baking using everything from generators to firewood to make sure that people would have food after the hurricane hit. So Cubans do have coffee and baked goods and electrolyte water because in Cuba, the needs of the people come first. In Florida, if you didn't have money to evacuate and had to be in your mobile home, in the Keys, well, you may not have survived. Returning to Radio Havana, Cuba, more than 6,000 people of Brazil's movement of homeless workers have occupied a park in São Bernardo do Campo to demand access to decent housing. The occupation has grown from 500 people since it first rallied under the banner of the Fearless People of São Bernardo last week. Guillermo Bulos, the coordinator of the movement, said the occupation will pressure City Hall to open a channel of negotiation and will not reintegrate until demands are met. The occupied area is abandoned and is under a court dispute. So President Michel Temer's neoliberal policies have forced thousands of families to live in extreme poverty in Brazil. Thousands of families belonging to the group have settled on the outskirts of Sao Paulo to demand access to decent and affordable housing. What's going on in Brazil? You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Resident Rump and his constituency have greatly accelerated white minority rule to the point that various pundits have been wondering if we are headed for a new civil war. And it seems to me that energy for a civil war is certainly coming from the presidency. As in all systems of oppression, it is becoming a near criminal offense to name it, to name the oppression. White House Communications Director Sarah Huckabee Sanders is calling for a black ESPN commentator to be fired simply for pointing out that Rump is a white supremacist who has surrounded himself with other white supremacists. It's simply a statement of fact, unless Sessions and Bannon and the others never existed. But the pressure has succeeded in getting ESPN to claim that the commentator, Jemele Hill, has acted inappropriately. Apparently, it's inappropriate to tweet the truth while Rump is in office. This is a statement of the National Association of Black Journalists. Jemele Hill, they write, is an award-winning veteran journalist who has distinguished herself for having insightful opinions and perspectives on a variety of topics. Having been successful along those lines for 20 years, she has been able to connect with viewers on ESPN as well as on various social media platforms. Notwithstanding, the National Association of Black Journalists supports Hill's First Amendment rights on all manners of discussion within and without, within and outside the world of sports, as they do not impinge on her duties as a host and commentator. End quote. Now, that's just reasonable, if you ask me. And the calls from the White House to fire her are pretty obnoxious and anti-democratic, I must say, because that really was free speech. Meanwhile, Russia Today has been forced to register as a state actor for the offense of covering Occupy Wall Street, reporting on the dangers of fracking, and perhaps worst, allowing an interview platform for presidential candidates who were excluded from the Demo-Republican debates last year. I can see that RT reports from the perspective of Russian media, but it's not like they call themselves Peoria Today. They're called Russia Today. It seems the American media government bloc is easily frightened. Perhaps they should be. It's increasingly difficult to govern a nation that has such a grotesque and worsening maldistribution of wealth. This is third world America. And I say that ironically because the phrase third world is such a racist and colonialist phrase. It came about when people were calling America and its allies or minions, depending on your perspective, the first world, calling the Soviet bloc the second world, and everyone who is unindustrialized the third world. The description of the third world was places in which the average citizen didn't have much of a chance, and I think that applies now to the United States. We've been well-trained to hate and fear each other along racial and economic lines. Perhaps there would be less support for imperialism and less general meanness if we Americans learned to respect our own human rights and to demand our own human rights first. We've been robbed by the ideology of the magic levitating bootstrap. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps somehow. An article 2 years ago in Counterpunch pointed that out precisely, and I want to quote it because, well, I don't think, because of the slowness of the robbery, I don't think people are aware of just how badly we've been screwed. Paul C. Roberts wrote, the U.S. Bureau of the Census released its report on U.S. household income by quintile. Every quintile, as well as the top 5%, has experienced a decline in real household income since their peaks. And in this case, he's saying a peak set in 99, which wasn't much of a peak, but I'll go on about that in a moment. The bottom quintile, that is the lower 20% or the lower fifth, if you like, has had a 17.1 decline in real income from the 99 peak. The fourth quintile, moving up from the bottom, has had a 10.8% fall in real income. The middle quintile has had a nearly 7% decline in real income. And the second, moving up towards the top, has had a 2.8% fall in real income. The top quintile has had a decline in real income. The top 1/5 of Americans. The top 5%, the top 1/20th, if you like, has experienced a 4.8 reduction in real income. And only the top 1% or less, mainly the 10th of 1%, has experienced growth in income and wealth. And this is from 2015. Everything is worse now. On April 3rd of 2015, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that 93 million Americans of working age are not in the workforce, a historical record. Normally, an economic recovery is marked by a rise in the labor force participation rate. But they say when discouraged workers are included among the measure of the unemployed, the U.S. unemployment rate is currently 23%, not the 5.2% reported figure. And again, these figures are 2 years old and everything's worse. In a recently released report, the Social Security Administration provides annual income data on an individual basis. Are you ready for this? In 2014, 38% of American workers made less than $20,000. 51% made less than $30,000. 63% made less than $40,000. And 72% of all American workers made less than $50,000 a year. The scarcity of jobs and the low pay are direct consequences of jobs offshoring. Under pressure from shareholder advocates, that is Wall Street and large retailers, U.S. manufacturing companies move their manufacturing abroad to countries where the rock-bottom price of labor results in a rise in corporate profits, executive performance bonuses, and stock prices. Everyone else, speaking for myself, gets screwed. The departure of well-paid U.S. manufacturing jobs is soon followed by the departure of software engineering, IT, and other professional service jobs. Incompetent economic studies by careless economists such as Michael Porter at Harvard and Matthew Slaughter at Dartmouth concluded that the gift of vast numbers of U.S. high-productivity, high-value-added jobs to foreign countries was a great benefit to the U.S. economy. And speaking for myself again, of course, what they mean when they say the U.S. economy is that 10th of 1% that they care about there at Harvard and Dartmouth. In articles and books, the author said, I challenge this absurd conclusion, and all of the economic evidence proves that he's correct. The promised better jobs that the new economy would create to replace the jobs gifted to foreigners never appeared. Instead, the economy creates lowly paid part-time jobs such as waitresses, bartenders, retail clerks, and ambulatory healthcare services, while full-time jobs with benefits continue to shrink as a percentage of total jobs. These part-time jobs do not provide enough income to form a household. And most of you listening to me are just saying, well, duh. Of course not. But let's look for a minute at just how bad it is and how we got there. As a Federal Reserve study reports, nationally, nearly half of 25-year-olds lived with their parents in 2012 to 2013, just up from 25% in 99. When half of 25-year-olds, he writes, cannot form households, the market for houses and home furnishings collapses. Finance is the only sector of the U.S. economy that is growing. The financial industry's share of GDP has risen from less than 4% in 1960 to double that today, as Michael Hudson has shown. Finance is not a productive activity. It's a looting activity, as he points out in his book, Killing the Host. Moreover, extraordinary financial concentration and reckless risk and debt leverage have made the financial sector a grave threat to the economy. The absence of growth in real consumer income means that there is no growth in aggregate demand to drive the economy. Consumer indebtedness limits the ability of consumers to expand their spending with credit. These spending limits on consumers mean that new investment has limited appeal to businesses. The economy simply cannot go anywhere except down as businesses continue to lower their costs by substituting part-time jobs for full-time jobs and by substituting foreign for domestic workers. Government at every level is over-indebted, and quantitative easing has oversupplied the U.S. currency. And if you're wondering what quantitative easing is, it's simply printing money. He writes, this is not the end of the story. When manufacturing jobs depart, research, development, design, and innovation follow. An economy that doesn't make things does not innovate. The entire economy is lost, not merely the supply chains. And he concludes, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the worst thing that ever happened to the United States. The two main consequences of the Soviet collapse have been devastating. One consequence was that the rise of the neoconservative hubris of U.S. world hegemony, which has resulted in 14 years of wars that have cost $6 trillion. The other consequence was a change of mind in socialist India and communist China, large countries that responded to the end of history by opening their vast underutilized labor forces to Western capital, which resulted in the American economic decline that this article describes, leaving a struggling economy to bear the enormous war debt. It's a reasonable conclusion that a social, political, economic system so incompetently run already is a third world country. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8255. 8187, 503-231, 8187. A disproportionate share of the nation's wealth is held in white hands, while households of color own a shrinking slice of the proverbial pie. Today, this translates into a racial wealth divide in which the median net worth of black and Latino families stands at just $11,000 and $14,000, respectively, a fraction of the $134,000 owned by the median white family. Even more disturbing is that when consumer durable goods such as automobiles, electronics, and furniture are subtracted, median wealth for black and Latino families drops to $1,700 and $2,000, respectively, compared to $116,000 for white households. That's from Alternet. And Steve is on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Teresa.
You're welcome.
I was hoping you might clarify your opening comments. If I were to, defend the right of someone to express themselves, and if those views were, hate speech, which I find abhorrent, either anti-Semitic or racist or homophobic, but if I defend their right to express that, did you say that I should expect to be punched in the face? Because that sounds counter to the principles upon which GABU is based.
That's an oversimplification. So let me walk you through it again. To support whiteness, which is a system of oppression, and to cover the armed intimidation and the murder campaign of death squads, such as the Klan and the Nazis, by saying that they should have equal rights in terms of having a platform for speech, is to pretend that they are not death squads, is to pretend that a Klansman or a Nazi getting up on the podium is not an act of armed intimidation. So if you get punched in the face, it's something that you brought on yourself because people need to defend themselves. So yeah, close enough.
And if someone were to, feel the same way, in a different community of our country, for instance, if they felt that flag burning or expressions of F the police was, included implicit threats of violence, they could take this similar action and violently react toward anyone who defends those expressions?
No, absolutely not, because of the context. Can I say it because of the context? Is that registering?
Again, who sets the context?
The context is set by the actors. It's like if I go and burn a flag, okay, what flag burner has ever blown up a church sneakily? What flag burner has a history of dragging, whoever they hate, let's say police? Do flag burners go and blow up police departments? Do they gun down police in the streets? Do they drag police by ropes behind their pickup trucks on rural roads? No, there's no context of violence. So if I burn a flag that's saying, I hate certain things about this flag, and so if you come and punch me, you're simply engaging in violence.
It's a priori logic. If you're consistent, then you would find both rationales. And I'm not defending violence on either case. So it's not like you're defending violence against speech that you find offensive, but...
You're just ignoring what I'm saying. You will not address the context. Context. Context.
Well, again, the ACLU, if you Google ACLU hate speech versus free speech, it's a very thoughtful presentation of the distinctions and the legal precedents that our First Amendment, keeps being, judged, used to balance. It is a balancing act. I just feel like, it's a slippery slope when you say that we're going to tolerate this kind of expression, flag burning or F the police, but we're not going to encourage other kinds of expression. And again, I've been very clear.
It's the context of violence that defines whether something is an act of intimidation or an act of free speech.
And who determines the context? Who would you have determine what the context is?
It's not hard when your people are being blown up, lynched, shot. This
again,
is not
who,
a difficult is determination.
Who?
Oh, who? So we need a separate group, some sort of godlike objectivity to determine when people are being shot to rags.
Who determines in when the heckler's veto can be employed or when a punch in the face is to be employed? I mean, you're saying that one is justified in some cases, but not in others. So, who's going to make this determination?
No. It's not like that. You're ignoring what I'm saying, that the context of violence makes it an act of intimidation. And the reason you're ignoring the context, I'm going to guess, is because you want to acknowledge the fact that to be white is to participate in violence. We need to destroy whiteness. We need to, people like you and me, need to revert to people who have a relatively pale skin, who come from, say, Poland or Ireland, and the whole concept of whiteness needs to be taken down for what it is, an act of supremacy and oppression.
I'm not a white supremacist. I reject it entirely. I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal because I believe in the First Amendment and a liberal interpretation of the First Amendment. Would you support Ann Coulter or Steve Bannon speaking at Berkeley?
No.
Okay. Good day.
You've proved nothing. You've ignored. I've put the context out there over and over again. And you've refused to engage it. So you can say good day, you can say good day and hang up, but it's basically dishonest. I mean, I want to hear that engaged. Do the Klan and Nazis, do they murder people? Are they murdering people? Are they a death squad or not? If they're not a death squad and I'm imagining all this murder, then my goodness, what a crime it is for me to say that they don't have free speech. And if they are murderers, and of course they are, then there's a distinction to be made between getting up on a platform as a part of your war against an oppressed section of the population and getting up on a platform and simply expressing your opinion. As I said, if it were a member of ISIS wearing black and flapping the ISIS flag, you'd wonder if they had an explosive vest on, and there'd be a good chance that they did. Your life would be in danger, and you'd say, get that person off the platform, we're in danger. But for some reason, when white people do it, it just doesn't matter. The context goes away, and we can all be white and say that these white murderers who murder for whiteness, who continue to murder for whiteness, just doesn't matter. And what you're really saying is that the people they murdered don't matter. And the fact that they are murdered doesn't matter. And it's okay to just continue with this continuum of whiteness. Whiteness is oppression. You can't escape that. So when Steve Bannon and Ann Coulter and Milos Yiannopoulos want to get up and do their thing and snarkily hang out with a crowd that includes, and they do support in print, on Twitter, wherever, you know, the Nazis and the Klan and the murder and the horror and the oppression, you would say that's the same as having someone up and just give their honest opinion? Or is it the same as someone burning a flag when there's no context of the flag burning resulting in any violence? It's not the same. So yeah, people have got a right to defend themselves. And I do. I'm transgender. Nazis want to attack me. You show up with a swastika, well, watch yourself. Because that swastika tattooed on your arm means that you intend to attack, and you have attacked, and you'll attack when I'm not looking, so I'll be watching you, and yes, it'll be tense. And that's my right. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Sunny's on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hey, you know, I was just going to say, Teresa, you're a toughie, but you know what? You're tough. You're tough. I know that you mean what you say just now. And we've got swastikas out in our street in front of the house here, probably due to my being a big mouth. Well, like that's any excuse for it. But I feel the same way that you just expressed. And I agree with the fellow called before for this reason, because this kind of hatred and cowardice is always percolating. And when they have a venue where they can speak and push their terrorism, and you're right, the way that they operate, you're completely, completely right, then we get the opportunity to confront them. And there's been a lot of confrontation. I think they've gotten a pretty big message that the majority of the country, as flawed as we are still, with so much work to do, are not going for it. We know what they're up to, and we know who they are, and we do not like them. And so when they come out, we get the opportunity to come out. Then the other thing, too, is if you start saying, you can't say this, you can't say that, and this is who you are, and we do know who they are. And I appreciate particularly how fervent and articulate you have been on this matter in pointing it out. You were the first one to ever use the phrase domestic terrorist against these Klan that I'd ever heard on the airwaves. But what if Trump and them work out something that just says, we don't like your opinion on this and that, and you're outlawed. You're not allowed to state this anymore. I think if people are allowed to get it off their chest, and we realize with these folks it's kind of the tip of the iceberg, it gives us a better opportunity to keep our eyes on them. And the other thing, too, it doesn't give them the opportunity to turn around at some point or some other faction to say, well, I don't like what you're saying. I don't like what you're thinking. It's getting shut down. We just got to keep it open, and we got to stay clear, and we got to identify them. And they're getting identified in this neighborhood, I'll tell you that. And it's hard, but our opinions may differ, but I very much appreciate how smart and articulate you are.
Well, thank you. Well, when it comes to giving a platform, the question is whether a student body should spend its money to bring someone in to speak.
Well, there's a good point. That's true.
That's a forum, that's a framework in which you have the opportunity to defend yourself against armed terrorists by saying, no, we're not going to have any armed terrorists up there. People who actually threaten members of our community are not going to come up there and propagate their program, which includes murder.
That's true there. I mean, they certainly shouldn't be paid for the opportunity, or to, maybe you could say, come talk to the school newspaper. You go ahead and you talk to our journalists, and you tell them what you're up to and what you're thinking, so everybody can read about it, but we're sure not going to give you a podium for that. As far as the gatherings out in public and their internet sites and all of that stuff, I think that might be a different element. But, yeah, students are already so much under debt for so much BS. It's a crime what's happening to all of our young people.
Well, sure. And, in the context of spending money, it's like the ACLU, I think, if they want to spend money addressing the Nazi and the Klan at all, the first money they should spend before they concern themselves with their free speech is make sure there's been sufficient investigation, especially considering how infiltrated these people are into police departments, to actually prosecute them for the crimes that they have committed and to get them locked up, and then we'll read their manifestos from jail.
The infiltration is a very important factor that has not been taken up, and thanks to you speaking about it and Joanne Hardesty thinking about it, it's still on our minds and in our hearts, and you're completely right about that. And thank you both. Thank you, Joanne. I hope she's listening so I can say thank you, Joanne. And thank you, Teresa, too.
Thanks for calling in.
Bye-bye.
Time is 9:34 Pacific. Been talking about, continuing the discussion this morning about free speech and what is free speech and what's armed intimidation and how to make a distinction. And also, and the point I really want to make here is don't be blinded by whiteness into saying that a terrorist group can speak as if that context did not exist, as if people that you know and live with and care about aren't threatened by their program of murder. And it is whiteness that blinds. That's a big part of whiteness, is pretending that certain aspects just don't happen, that we don't have to look there, we don't have to think about that, we don't have to think about the context. Think about the context. I was talking about the disparity of wealth, current trends, according to the article that I was reading previously, suggests that by 2024, median black household wealth will have declined by a total of about 30% from where it stands today. And where it stands today is horrifying. In that same time frame, the median Latino family can expect to see their net worth decline by a total of 20% over today's levels. By then, median white household wealth will have increased about 5% over today's levels. Now, there's many reasons why this is happening. Going back nearly 75 years, the federal government prioritized policies favoring home ownership for whites, but not for non-whites. One example from the post-World War II is the government would not make home loans to black veterans. That policy and others, such as making mortgage interest rates deductible, gave an edge to families with a higher foothold on the economic ladder, in other words, to whites. However, the election of President Trump and GOP Congress is deepening these long-simmering structural factors. Because the administration is shifting resources up the economic ladder or removing protections that kept lower and middle class people from slipping down. Median income in 1975 was $8,630.92. That's the equivalent, and this is my writings now that I'm reading from, that's the equivalent of more than $40,000 now. A working couple would be making $80,000 at that rate, in that 1975 rate. That was a median income. My father was pretty much in the middle or the upper middle of white male earners at that time. He had a bachelor's degree and a CPA, and I lived in 1975 in a suburb north of San Antonio, Texas, which is situated between a cheaper suburb and a more expensive suburb. And I got new clothes every season, new pajamas, and lived in a peaceful, quiet neighborhood. There were two cars in the garage, and they weren't very old. He earned $35,000 per year, the equivalent of $160,000 in 2017 dollars. And that was not considered unusual for his level of education. I was very privileged indeed, and that level of wealth and privilege was the leverage that the ruling class used back then to buy off what they like to call the silent majority and to silence any consideration of socialism. My point is that we have all been steadily screwed by corporate rule since then, earning less and becoming more unstable in our living situation every year. It's very bad that I need to say that there were not beggars at every major intersection then. That people were not trying to survive in tents on the sidewalks. Of course, that goes double and triple for everyone who is not a white male like my dad. Meanwhile, total compensation for the 0.1% has skyrocketed, and yes, that is where the money went. We have been boiled slowly like frogs in a gumbo pot. We have all been robbed of our place in society, and to keep us quiet, some have been robbed more than others. So you get the thin gruel of white supremacy, and that's supposed to do for you. It's a pretty thin payoff, but the sad thing is it tends to work. Obviously, it works for 60 million Trump voters. It doesn't reflect well on human nature. In this context, steps Bernie Sanders, yesterday sponsoring a bill to introduce single-payer health care by expanding Medicare. He could not frighten the establishment more if he had lit a stick of dynamite and tossed it Zapata-style into the Senate floor. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And Jersey's on the air.
Hey.
Hello there.
Yep. Just going to turn my thing down here. Yeah. Sorry about that. So once again, you're hitting the nail on the head pretty well, Teresa, and I want to add to it in the context issue, because when I asked myself the question of just exactly what the free speech rights, you know, of Nazis are, I'm even less intellectual, but, you know, a little bit simplistic, but I think it's a safe place to go for the ACLU if they ever do. And that is, they themselves, as the Nazis, clearly do not believe in civil rights or free speech. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for them to justify. So what they're very afraid of is saying to the rest of the liberal population that they're going to bend the rules away from the idea that everyone has that free speech. And what it seems to me that if your own client does not support free speech, you can be purely justified as a nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting free speech to not defend them. How can you possibly defend somebody who doesn't believe in what your work is?
It's so, how you define free speech. You know, if we're in a room and I pull a gun on you and say, "Do you like my hair?" Whatever you say is not free speech because one person in the room is not free.
Right. And as far as I'm concerned, I mean that's easy. I mean, I'm not taking it from an intellectual end. I'm just saying it's like, that's you're in a position to say you're not supporting what I'm fighting for, and you're asking me to fight for you. Why should I be there? And I think I'm putting the challenge out to the ACLU, because this is one that's bothered me a number of years with the ACLU. Although, you know, 80% whatever they've done, they've done pretty well. But this is the one that is now, it's kind of important. It's kind of really important that they do actually take the stand and make their distinction.
Well, I don't want to beat up on the ACLU too much. I said they are changing. I didn't really research their latest position before I went on the air, so I could be doing something wrong here. But what I do, the distinction I do want to make is that, you know, with white people, it's people who are not subject to the terror of the Klan that say the Klan has free speech.
Right. And your position is perfectly justified in terms of defensive violence and everything else. And I'll even go into the direction of a challenge to all of the young folks, which apparently more part of the alt-right, whatever that is today, than many others, sort of a new version. And if you're a white, working middle class or working class or poor class person, and you're a male and you're between the ages of, you know, say 17 and 35, and you're part of this, I put a challenge because I was once in that category myself. And that is, when you felt your white economic oppression, theoretically, was it because you actually believed that the black people and the women around you were being elevated in a direction while you were still basically struggling? Or is it that most people around you were still struggling and then a few people squeezed in and sold them out to the capitalist man? Just ask yourself that question. And then once you're done that question, you can say, okay, I'm in the wrong camp. I should be working with everybody else who has been held down.
Yeah, the funny thing is everyone benefits. The more equal the system gets, the more everyone benefits.
Right. Anyway, that's all for now, Teresa.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. I'm going to talk about healthcare a little bit now. Because, Bernie Sanders yesterday sponsored a bill to introduce single-payer health care. And this is what the parasite class has always feared. And it's the reason Sanders was given such incredibly thin coverage during the presidential primary season. It's the reason Occupy Wall Street was demonized, infiltrated, tear-gassed, and beaten. It's the reason Oliver Twist caused such a hubbub in the novel. Oh, the horror, the fear, the trembling that even now is vibrating the leather seat cushions and the marble-appointed private jet cabins. Just when they hoped everyone had forgotten the word socialism, you can bet right now, resident Rump and his cohorts and the Republican leadership and just about every billionaire in the country is desperately hoping North Korea will set off another nuke or light up a missile, or better yet, test a nuclear bomb on a missile. They had better come through. They're needed, so very needed now, as a distraction. Because once U.S. citizens start thinking in terms of human rights, it's a slippery slope to asking for decent wages and working conditions. And maybe people will, and this would really make the rich shudder, will think about actual democracy rather than cola and smartphone purchases. Maybe someone will catch on to the fact that housing is a universally recognized human right. Someone might start demanding economic participation and a rational distribution of wealth. And what will happen then to Martin Shkreli's PharmaBro millions? Won't someone think of the super rich? The super rich are furious that they are forced to once again mention socialized medicine, even to denounce it. Quoting spokesman Sarah of the Rump administration, I think that the president, as well as the majority of the country, knows that the single-payer system that the Democrats are proposing is a horrible idea. She said, I can't think of anything worse than having the government be more involved in your health care instead of less involved, end quote. And this is because, of course, Sarah and her boss, Resident Rump, are terribly concerned about your health and general welfare. They lose sleep every night worrying about that tumor on your sister's breast. That diabetic amputation that your father is risking really makes them cry into their champagne flutes, yes. Republican leadership really has your best interest at heart. They're such caring people, you know. Got an article from Sarah Martin of Consumer Affairs, but before I get to it, have a call on the line. Charles.
Good morning, Ms. Mitchell. Thank you.
Good morning.
I think, you know, it's really important that we fight fascism and racism at every opportunity. I think that one thing that some of these alt-right people or the Trumpsters that may or may not qualify as alt-right are saying is, well, Donald Trump's not really a racist, and that it's possible that that could be true. He's only coincidentally giving a shield to racists to maintain this 1% oligarchy. He doesn't really care, you know, Oprah, he doesn't care what happens to Oprah. He doesn't hate Oprah for being black, but he loves the fact that when he says, there were good people on both sides in Charlottesville, that then we, coming from a privileged white background myself, we're now spread thin. Not only do we have to fight the oligarchy that wants us to deny us health care and housing, we also have to try and save people of color from being shot by Mark Kruger's police. And so that there are real racists and fascists, but it doesn't matter whether Donald Trump is an actual believer in the inferiority of everybody who's not white, or just a selfish, greedy oligarch and tool of the oligarchs.
Because he is acting powerfully to increase the power of that system. So, yeah, he is effectively racist. I don't know what's in his brain and don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's true. It's that the oligarchic system is racist, although, you know, there's the complication of there are other billionaire oligarchs of diverse racial backgrounds, the regime in Saudi Arabia, et cetera, you know, which has only got there by cooperating hand in hand with, you know, a London, New York based system of pushing. But locally, you know, we have to ask, and it's been put in print some, our elected leaders, you know, particularly our mayor, disgustingly similar to Donald Trump. Maybe not perfectly matched in rhetoric, but in results. And when you look at what happened in Portland, white supremacists, alt-righters, are never subjected to state violence. And people who stand up to try and protect communities of color that were just on the previous show, Rabbi Ariel Stone, Ned Roche from Jewish Voice for Peace, what Lou Frederick was in the streets on June 4th watching the Portland police, which may or may not be under the control of the mayor, defend patriot prayer. So locally, regardless of the mess in Washington, D.C., we need to realize that the same racist system is operating, that it was the choice of our previous mayor to award a Nazi $5,000, Mark Kruger.
And, yeah, instead of, I mean, let me address that for a moment. He was, you know, and we all know the reasons why he was awarded the money. It had to do with the union activity, the legal obligations, blah, blah, blah. But there's another context, and that's the fact that, you know, when we find someone in the force who is affiliated with a death squad, we don't call it a death squad. We don't call it a terrorist group. We have laws to prosecute people who collaborate, we have conspiracy laws, for God's sakes, to bring down people who collaborate with and cooperate with and are a part of terrorist and violent organizations. And we do not enforce those laws. We give the white people a pass. We give the white institution a pass. We give the mayor and the institutions that should be calling for this, demanding it, insisting it, purging all of the Nazis and the Klan from the police force, or creating a new police force and pensioning off whoever we have so that we don't have a group of people that you have to fear on the basis of your skin color and whether or not you're gay or lesbian or transgender. I mean, that is a part of whiteness and apartheid and the rule of the rich and the white, and that's how it's done. It's what they refuse to even consider. It's what we don't talk about. It's that silence is so important to the system of oppression. And you know, when you look at it from a distance, you know, when people see us from another country, that's pretty clear to them. We manage to fool ourselves that, oh, there's this rule and that rule, and oh, our hands are tied. And they're not.
Absolutely. And I think that I was also glad with your strong stance against the so-called liberal, the first caller you had on your show. It's like, you know, I personally we don't know that gentleman's whole background. He may have been marching with Dr. Martin Luther King or working with, even though I'm not a big fan of Al Sharpton, he did go in the streets against the CIA crack delivery conspiracy in New York. He had actual boots on the ground work to uplift his community. And then when a caller comes in and says that they value free speech, you know, not that they don't value human quality of life, they just value Ann Coulter's freedom of speech and Steve Bannon's freedom of speech. I think that you handle that quite well. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for calling in. Well, I've been trying to talk about health care as well, and Bernie Sanders has introduced a bill which is, frankly, socialized health care. And that word, socialized, absolutely terrifies the very rich, and you are supposed to hate socialism. And that's a thought paradigm that was much better enforced 30 years ago than it is now. People would absolutely jump if you said socialist or communist, and you can insult someone by calling them a socialist or a communist. And they still try to do that in the Senate, by the way. I noticed that the Washington Post had a very disdainful article about Sanders. Basically, Sanders' bill and Sanders. And what Sanders wants to promote is just bringing America into the 21st century and joining all comparable nations that have systems for providing health, which is a human right, and just doesn't matter what you say otherwise. Of course, it's a human right. And they, for example, repeat the Republican talking points that we don't know how it'll be funded. Well, that's not true. It'll be funded by a progressive tax, and they don't want to hear that word. It's like the word didn't happen. Well, how will you fund it? Well, progressive tax. Well, how will you fund it? A progressive tax. Well, how will you fund it? It was sort of like a conversation I had earlier. There's some things that you just don't talk about. Those are exactly the things that we need to talk about. That's what KBOO is for, actually. This is the reason I do this show, is to persistently bring up the things that, well, maybe we'd rather not think about and try. And that's how we move to a better society, is actually having the courage to use our brains and our hearts to move forward. The number to call, 503-231-8187. LJ is on the air.
Hey, Teresa, good morning.
Good morning.
Teresa, may we talk about Manifest Destiny?
Manifest Destiny, the right of white people from the United States to crush all people, especially if they have darker colored skin, in Southern and Central America and the Philippines. Manifest Destiny.
And didn't the white people get that message from God telling them that they were superior to every other person on Earth?
Oh, yeah, there's some sort of convoluted religious thing that has to do with, let's see, how's it work? It's like...
And wasn't Manifest Destiny used as a reason to massacre all Native people who lived in this part of the world?
Yep.
And I'll take my responses off the air. Teresa, have a great day, and great job as usual.
Thank you.
They ought to put you on the payroll, damn it.
No, they really shouldn't, because this is volunteer radio, and I'm very grateful for what I've been able to do here. And I've done it as a volunteer, and I've done it for 30 years since, 31 years since 1986, started on Black Radio, KAZI in Austin. And I've been here at KBOO since 1990. I found one of my scripts from 1990 just yesterday. We're coming up on Membership Drive, Pledge Drive, and I want to comment about that. We'll be starting that tomorrow. I'll be doing my Pledge Drive show next week, so you don't need to call in with your contribution right now. But this sort of thing, dissenting radio, radio where you can, you know, listen to some different thought, is so important right now. And you're not going to hear just a heck of a lot of anarcho-socialist thought on the radio. This is for you. This is for the people of the Cascadian region. We get together, we act for ourselves and on behalf of the community, and that means all of us. And we do that as best we can, and we try to follow our inclusive and progressive rules, and we keep a charter to that effect, and it has an effect. It has an effect on this region. I think it's needed more than ever, and I urge you to build up that sense of solidarity in your heart and think of yourself. I mean, if you can hear me, then you're the community that I'm talking about. And I do this for you, and I've been so rewarded doing this. I am so grateful for all these many years. I'm really privileged to have been able to come up to the studio every week thousands of times now. And work on what I hope will be a better world, and to work against the oppression that we call whiteness, and to work at liberating my fellow whites from whiteness. And won't that be nice? That's going to be good, people. We can get there. That's going to be a better place. We can have a better world. I believe that. And this radio station is such an effective tool for that movement. And so, yeah, you do need to kick down a little money every month to keep this on the air. And a lot of you do. And thank you so much. And the majority don't. And a lot of you simply cannot afford it. And so next week when I ask for money, understand that if you can't afford, you know, like if you need that money for your kids' lunch, then I'm not asking for that. We're here for you. But a lot of us, you know, a certain percentage of the people listening to KBOO, even though we skew to the working class, and maybe I should say the working hard class, a certain percentage of you can afford to participate, and you really should. And you should do it substantially. You should do it substantially, shouldn't you? If you care about community, if you understand the satisfaction and the joy and the moral rectitude of being part of your community and moving for a better world, then, yeah, you need to be part of KBOO. You need to join us over these next 2 weeks as we raise our funds. So you've been listening to Press Watch, and I was talking about Bernie Sanders. I have all kinds of script if I had had time, if I'd gotten to it, that I would have talked about Bernie Sanders' healthcare bill, which will be funded by a progressive tax, and a progressive tax will be far less than you are paying now for health insurance, simply because you don't have to pay billionaires. And if I'd gotten to the script, I would have named the billionaires and the amounts that they are making, but I'll simply say, since the music is already running here, that the reason healthcare is so expensive is because of the gigantic profits. Yes, they are making, even after the ACA, they are making gigantic profits, billions and billions of dollars of profits. The CEOs are raking in billions of dollars, and that will be gone under socialized healthcare, which you had best fight for as hard as you can right now. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell.